everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you along with Tom Fairbanks. Tom, I can't believe some of these images I'm seeing out of California in the High Sierra. 800 inches up at the summit at Mammoth Mountain. Well, 700 inches is kind of the average. That's 60 feet of snow this winter.
My question is, when was the last time they even saw 700 inches? Probably a few years ago.
This breaks the record. 1952 was a bit over 700 inches, but now it is official. It is a record in the Sierra for this winter for the snowpack. Really unbelievable.
I wonder if these river flows are going to continue from now on every winter, or is this just an anomaly of some kind?
I don't know, but that's something that we'll put that question to Dr. Zach Guido, who is our guest here in a moment. It is Thursday. It's April 6th, 2023, the show in our 13th year. We're in the Green Thing, Zilkalo Village Studios, 1030 KVOI, The Voice. Trusted news and talk. Worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. Our telephone interviews are presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. With me in studio, Dr. Zach Guido, the Buckmaster Show contributor on climate. He is an assistant research professor at AIR. AIR is an acronym for Arizona Institute for Resilience, which coordinates interdisciplinary groups of faculty, students, and projects across the University of Arizona's campus, from climate science to public policy, law, the arts, water resources, and beyond. Hey, Zach, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, as always.
Tom was just asking, you know, there's been at least 12 atmospheric rivers, big rain producers. I think it may be 14, but they're expecting maybe even one more next week. Tom was asking, is this something we might see every winter?
This is certainly the story of the winter, these atmospheric rivers. But
yeah,
the short answer to that question is yes, because they happen every year. And in fact, these atmospheric rivers, it's a really sort of descriptive name, and basically what it is are these areas of really moist water in the atmosphere that get channeled in from the tropics and stream in. They progress as you move through the winter. So these atmospheric rivers are first striking sort of northern parts of the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and as the winter sort of progresses, they naturally sort of strike more southern areas. So they happen every year. For California, they end up bringing like 50% of their annual rain.
Mm-hmm.
The question is the frequency and the strength of these, and this year has been exceptionally high in terms of the number. There's a group at Scripps that monitor this, and they
out of the southern, that's San Diego area.
That's
right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm the name of the
oceanic group at Scripps.
Yeah. But if you were to search like Scripps atmospheric rivers, it would take you to this center, and they do a lot of the research. They've got some great monitoring tools, you know, and they've counted this year 31.
Now 31.
They break them down into extreme, strong, yeah, moderate, and weak.
Whoa.
So you might have been talking about the strong ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, so there it's been, and that's above average. I don't know what the average is offhand, but I can confidently say that it's above average. And, the outcome of that, there's a couple outcomes, both positive and negative. Certainly from a water perspective and a landscape perspective. I mean, you look across the West for the most part, and the snowpacks are fantastically high.
We haven't talked about Utah. We kind of mentioned Colorado and California when we start talking of snowpacks, but places I want to say Alta are at record areas too.
Yeah, I mean. Again, the snowpacks are some of the highest snowpacks. There's a lot of extreme values, and most of them, in the high country in the Rockies, in the sort of central and southern Rockies, are much, much above average. And you know, just eyeballing it, like if I can't remember a winter looking at the data where the average sort of conditions across the West have been snowpack conditions have been this high. Again, you have to go up to like northern Oregon, you know, northern Idaho, northern Montana and Washington to find sort of near average and below average snowpack conditions. So from the water perspective and the landscape perspective, fire and whatnot, like this is about as good of a winter as you can expect.
Yes.
You know, of course, the flip side of that is obviously like these atmospheric rivers and severe storms bring quite a bit of hardship and destruction and damage, floods, destruction of property. You know, there's been people have lost their lives. So, I mean, that's the sort of tragic side of it.
So it's obvious that the for folks that we're talking about snow with the runoff in the Sierra going to the west, filling reservoirs, the question now becomes Colorado, Utah, good snowpack, some cases records. What does that mean for the Colorado River? Because this, the Sierra does not generally impact any of our Colorado River situation.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's a good situation for the water supply over in California. And I should also say, if you look at the Sierras, I think the central Sierras and the southern Sierras are near their record snowpack conditions, and the northern Sierras are just slightly below their record. So you have to go back to like 82, 83, I think was the year that they experienced their maximum, and this year is surpassing that. But to the Colorado, you know, all of our eyes here in, you know, Arizona and the seven states that actually draw water off the Colorado, like look to the snowpack conditions in largely in the high country in Colorado and Utah. And, you know, we've, as I'm sure your listeners know, we've been in this protracted.
At least 20 years.
Yeah, period.
Some would say 1,000 years or 1,200 years.
Yeah, of dwindling water supplies in our major basins. And, you know, part of that is a climate story. A large part of that is also the fact that we know that there's more water being allocated in the river than actually falls in rain and snow. So the water supply situation in the Colorado River is not in a good state. And, you know, people have been, Bureau of Reclamation and the government, they've been trying to figure out how to like make sure that the water levels don't fall below certain thresholds that prevent energy to be generated.
And that is called generally a dead pool. That's what we want to avoid at all costs.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So that situation is not dramatically going to change this year. The good news is the stream flow forecasts for the spring runoff are actually really high. So Colorado, the expected stream flow forecast into Lake Powell will be something like 170% of average. That is really helpful, but we would need like 10 of these winters back to back to back to dramatically change the water supply story. But it is good news. But the people that think about this and manage the water will still need to figure out ways to make sure people get their allocations, but also that we're keeping the reservoirs at a healthy level. And that's a tough thing to do.
You know, early in my career, I spent time as the news guy over in Visalia, which is the county seat for Tulare County. I was over there in the early 70s, and I heard talk there. People, the old-timers would say, well, we used to have the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi. It was called Tulare Lake. At one point, it was 800 square miles in the San Joaquin Valley. Well, it was drained off in the 50s and dammed. And guess what? It's back.
It's back. Wow.
It's back, not to that giant size, but it is growing by the day with this runoff because the water, there's just nowhere for that water to go right now in California.
Yeah. And again, I mean, it's a really exceptional year. You know, I think the story is not to count on this happening again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, likely, you know, if irrigation or water use for agriculture or urban areas like continues to draw from, you know, groundwater and reservoirs, like the same sort of, we live in an environment with not a lot of water. It's an arid West and people use water and it's a scarce resource. And so, I wouldn't expect again, this winter to dramatically change that, those challenges, but by all accounts, I think it's a welcome sign. Last year we had a dry winter. You know, we've had two back-to-back monsoon, great monsoon seasons, mm-hmm. generational monsoon seasons. Mm-hmm. I think this is a generational winter season. It's hard to imagine that. I'm not even sure generational is the right word anymore, given that we've now had three, like, you know, two monsoons and a winter with like really. Unusually cold weather, and
I don't know about Tucson, but I know Phoenix had the in 30 years it was the coolest winter up there, and I'm sure Tucson is probably right up there.
Yeah, I mean it's been, and that's yes, it has been below average. I haven't looked at the rankings, mm-hmm. So I don't know where they fall, but it's certainly been below average across the West. You know, that also feeds back and is a good thing for the snowpacks because you get less evaporation. It stays on the landscape longer. More of it flows into the rivers, adds to the stream flow. So the precipitation and the temperature often go hand in hand in the winter, in part because our storms can come in from northern parts of our, you know, the Pacific Northwest, for example. And so they can often entrain cold air.
All right. We'll have more with our climate scientist, Dr. Zach Guido from the University of Arizona. We've been talking about above average and exceptional. Those words certainly fit Zach Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise, open right now for lunch. They do a great lunch. We talk so much about the breakfast, and why not? Those pastries are wonderful, but they do a great lunch as well. Their website is monasdanishbakery.com, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise, open 6:30 in the morning, Tuesday through Saturday, 7 o'clock Sunday morning. My advice, get there early for your best selection of your, well, my favorite right now, if I could have one of those, let's see. I love the Kringle, of course, but a croissant, an almond croissant, Zach, would go very nice right now.
Sounds amazing.
All right, we'll take a break. More with Zach Guido right after this.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Welcome back. Dr. Zach Guido with us on the Buckmaster Show, our contributor on climate. Dr. Guido, University of Arizona climate scientist. Zach, it probably won't come as a surprise to you, but the United States leads the world in weather catastrophes. This was from the Associated Press, and they list everything from tornadoes, hurricanes, flash floods, droughts, wildfires, blizzards. I can go on, and I will for another moment. Ice storms, severe thunderstorms. And why do we lead the world in these disasters? Well, in real estate, they always say location, location, location. And same thing applies to North America. You got two oceans.
It's a big country.
Big country. And we have a lot of stuff that happens. And unfortunately, with climate change, Zach, more of the severe stuff is happening and almost becoming a new norm.
Yeah. So I don't know I didn't read that article or know how they're defining.
Yeah, I kind of sprung that on you.
How they're defining catastrophes. But I think there's an important point here, which is part of like disasters are socially constructed, as they say. So people, you know, quibble a lot about the definitions that there are no such things as natural disasters. It's because of the human component of it that creates those. And there's an underlying sort of social vulnerability that leads to impact. So for example, you know, we know that a lot of people in the U.S. Live on floodplains.
Yes.
And in fact, there's flood insurance that some people might argue is part of the cause, or it allows people to stay in places that are vulnerable. You know, you've also have economically disadvantaged people that tend to be pushed to more risky and environments.
Case in point, Louisiana.
Okay, exactly. Yep. With the hurricanes.
Sure.
You know, we've got a lot of people, high value real estate, for example, in California, living in forests that historically burn.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a vulnerability part of the disaster equation. And, you know, even if I'll get to the climate change part in a minute, but even if you didn't think about climate change and just thought, hey, we have a climate like the climate that was, you know, for the last 10,000 years, like our, you know, citizens and the citizens around the world would still be vulnerable and experience these disasters, in part because we're not really weather ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a tornado is going to do destruction. A hurricane is going to cause a lot of destruction. So then you add on an element of climate change, which for some things we know is causing the frequency and the magnitude of the events, like a heat wave, for example, from the climate change is adding on to those heat waves, you know, a degree or degree and a half Fahrenheit. And, you know, that matters. So the climate change is sort of an amplifier to the risks that we already experience because, you know, we're not really resilient to, you know, the current weather. And I think there's a lot of efforts now that are underway to be more resilient to, you know, weather variability, you know, daily weather, seasonal change, and this sort of longer term trends that we're now experiencing as a result of climate change.
In late May, you'll be back with your monsoon forecast, but generally, what's your gut feeling about the summer rainy season based on the kind of wacky weather we've had this winter?
Yeah, this is great. So the answer is, from a scientific perspective, is mm-hmm. we don't really have good tools to predict the monsoon. And the reason for that is because it's a really complicated phenomenon. There's a lot of potential contributors to it, particularly as we're on the sort of northern fringes of it. It just makes the prediction really difficult. And it's even challenging to predict 2 weeks to 10 days. And so months in advance, it's you know, it's a flip of the coin, quite frankly. So now I often do wishful forecasting, I'm hopeful. I guess on the one hand, I'm hopeful that it's another really vigorous monsoon season because those are really interesting and fun, and it brings quite a bit of excitement. But I guess I would say, if you wanted me to bet on it right now, given that we've had two back-to-back monsoon seasons, it just seems hard from a chance perspective that we would experience three. But, you know,
sounds like you're hedging toward below average.
If I were to put my money on something,
I bet you're going to say below average. If you had to put the money down right now, you'd say below average.
I'll also say this. I mean, there's been some theories that have sort of weak signals in the scientific literature about the onset of the monsoon, mm-hmm. and that is, like, years with larger snowpacks tend to have later onsets of the monsoon, and when you have a later onset of the monsoon, you just cut off a few days of rainfall events, and then, like, the totals over that monsoon is less.
Would that be just, in my guess, all the snow on the ground reflection might not get as much of the storm clouds or something? Is there anything like that?
Yeah, so the mechanism would be in part that.
Yeah.
And then evaporation, it leads to sort of like a regional slight cooling.
Yes.
Then a delayed warming.
Mm-hmm.
And then that influences the progression of the high pressure system to our south, which really, as that moves north into Arizona, New Mexico, that's when we can get the incursions of moist air from the south and southeast.
So you're going to need that. You need definitely the wind direction, but you also need the temperature.
Yeah, I would say, though, that this idea looked like it was more influential about 10, 15 years ago, and the last 10, 15 years of data sort of have not sort of confirmed this idea. But I would say that this year, given the snowpack, is another strong test on that. And I mean, again, as we're trying to make predictions out far in advance of the monsoon, we're looking for factors that have some persistence in them, and snowpack would be one of those factors. But also, there are others, which makes it challenging. So I'll just wait and see. I'll take like a below average for just based on the last 2 years, and I'll cross my fingers for another. But maybe there'll be some more insight.
We see you again in May, late May, you may have, as we get within just weeks of the traditional start of the summer rainy season, which, according to the National Weather Service now, is June 15th. For years, it was all that, to the layman, the confusing dew point mm-hmm. and all that. Did we hit dew point or certain dew point for three straight nights? So now they just, from, you know, they say June 15th.
Makes it easier to communicate.
Yeah. Oh, I was just thinking about, you know, getting back to our lead topic about that snowpack. I bet there's snow on the ground and maybe even a substantial amount of snow all through the summer in certain places in the Sierra.
I think it's going to persist for a long time, particularly at the higher elevations. I mean, we'll have to see how warm it gets in the spring and in the early part of the summer. But
skiing at Mammoth in July, I bet people are already thinking about that.
Well, I think actually some ski mountains, and I remember reading a tweet about this, are already saying that they're going to stay open
for their summer,
longer
for summer skiing.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, like, it'd be hard pressed to find a better winter writ large than we've had here in terms of snow and rainfall.
Thanks, Zach. Always a pleasure. We'll look forward to seeing you in late May. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a break right here. Dr. David Levy is coming up next on our live line presented by Rincon Ventures right after this.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studios. Our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. By the way, Green Things, perfect time of year now that the cool spell is over. We've got some very warm temperatures coming. Perfect time this weekend to put spring flowers in your garden. Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. Their website has a lot of information about what they have available. GreenThingsAZ.com. Their sister business on site is Zocalo Village. Their website, ZocaloVillage.com. On our live line from his observatory in Vail, Arizona, Dr. David Levy, our contributor on science, former science editor of Parade Magazine, and now head of and the founder of the Sharing the Sky Science Educational Organization. Dr. Levy, one of the most successful comet discoverers in history, discovering 23 comets, including his co-discovery of Shoemaker-Levy 9, the comet that collided with Jupiter in 1994, producing the most spectacular explosions ever witnessed in the solar system. David, how are you, sir?
Hello, Bill. And I was enjoying your commercial just now for Green Things. With the winter we've had, I have more green things in my yard than I know what to do with.
Yeah, I've got a few of those, too. Some of the more rather, let's put it this way, rather unwelcome green things in the form of weeds.
We've got a few. It's not too bad, but... It's green. It's the greenest desert.
There was an important anniversary in late March, and that was the actual, what was the 30-year anniversary of the actual discovery of Shoemaker-Levy 9.
That's right.
Yeah.
That happened on March 23rd, and it was kind of overtaken by the fact that it would have been Wendy and my 26th wedding anniversary on the same day. That was a very important anniversary. It's 30 years ago that this happened. It's not the brightest comet that I found, but sure, certainly the most important.
Well, certainly on a national and international stage, David Levy, you will be remembered for the Shoemaker-Levy 9, because it was about a year later that there was this incredible collision with Jupiter. At the time of the discovery, David, 30 years ago in March, did you think or did you have a feeling that this thing was something very special?
Oh, yeah. The minute Carol and Bruno were all sitting on this very cloudy, snowy afternoon at Palomar, and Jean is reading Time magazine and I'm doing my email, and Carolyn is scanning, and suddenly she says, "I don't know what I've got, but it looks like a squashed comet." And Jean got up to look, and Carolyn came towards me, and I looked at her and smiled, and he said, "That's a good joke. You're kidding." And she said, "I'm not kidding. You better look at this."
Wow.
And oh, my goodness. And it turned out it was orbiting Jupiter, and May 22nd, of 1993, we found out that it's going to collide.
Hmm.
And that upended our lives, really.
Wow, I didn't realize you had that much kind of advance notice there was going to be the collision.
16 months, actually.
Wow. And the collaboration with the Shoemakers, I believe there were this was the ninth collaboration with them?
No, it was the ninth periodic comet, which means a comet that orbits the sun in 200 years or less.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of other comets that just come once and never go. And I believe the total number that we found together was 17.
Wow.
So there are a lot of them, and some of those were a lot brighter. One of the periodic Shoemaker-Levy 6 I was able to see right after we discovered it with my 6-inch diameter telescope right outside the observatory. And there was another one, 1992 A-1, which was, 1991 A-1, which turned out to be quite a nice comet that you could see with a small telescope.
Wow, just amazing. 30 years, wow. We've got a meteor shower coming that's going to be pretty impressive, right?
Yeah, the Lyrid meteors, and it's important, very important for me, Bill, because the Lyrid meteor shower is, when I watched it with my, as I call my practice wife, back in 1976, I was outside with a group of people in Montreal, and we saw a few meteors, and I casually thought about people in the past years and centuries that might have been looking at those same meteors. And then my mind wandered a bit, and I thought, I wondered about non-astronomers, like poets and playwrights that might have seen that. And on that particular moment, that launched my professional career on the relationship of the night sky with English poetry. And that goes on to this day, which leads us into the quotation that I'm going to do later.
All right. I think we are ready for the Dr. David Levy quote of the month. Go ahead, Dr. Levy.
Okay. When I was a teenager, just getting started, the observatory people told me that they wanted me to spot these 300 craters on the moon, and they gave me a map to help. And one of the craters that I found was Rabbi Levi. And I was pretty impressed with that, and I told everybody, there's a Levy on the moon. And they kind of took it as information, were pretty bored by it. And it wasn't until recently that I found out that Rabbi Levi, or Levi Ben Gerson, was a French astronomer in the 14th century who invented the Jacob's staff. And I found out just not long ago that Shakespeare talks about the Jacob's staff, although the official writing that the notes that I have in my Shakespeare refer to Jacob's staff in Genesis and Jacob's staff in the New Testament book of Hebrews. But I think he talked about Gersonides' staff, which was this wonderful very small wooden pole with a right angle pole that you can use to measure angles in the sky. Hmm. I like to call it the 14th century version of the James Webb Space Telescope. Anyway, the quotation is from Shylock, The Merchant of Venice, Act 2, Scene 5, 36-39. By Jacob's staff I swear, I have no mind of feasting forth tonight, but I will go. Go ye before me, sirrah, say I will come. And the first line is that by Jacob's staff I swear.
Okay.
And I like to think that Shakespeare knew about the Jacob's staff. It wouldn't have been that old in his time.
There you go. David Levy, thank you very much, and a blessings to you this Passover season, this Holy Week. And I hope things are going well, and we will talk to you in early May, the month of May.
Yeah, we will. And isn't it good news that Francis is doing so much better?
Much better.
Yeah, I'm very happy to hear that.
Thank you so much,
sir. The world needs him right now.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks. All right.
Take care, Bill.
Okay, that will do it for Dr. David Levy. We've got Don Luce, our legal contributor. Wow, there's no shortage of things to talk about with the consular today after all the legislatures turning out legislation, and a lot of it's getting vetoed. We'll be right back with Don Luce.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org. The Regional Transportation Authority Plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. Welcome back in the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studios. Thinking about a spring getaway, how about Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico? About a three-hour drive, southwestnewmexico.org. Great starting place, where to stay, some great places, all sorts of activities. The Gila National Wilderness looking great. Great time of year to do some hiking. And the temperatures, wow. About 80 degrees early next week over there. So spring has sprung. We are joined in studio with attorney Don Luce of the Luce Law Group, offices in Tucson and Phoenix. Mr. Luce is our legal contributor. He's the author of two very popular books, Arizona Laws 101, A Handbook for Non-Lawyers in Estate Planning in Arizona, What You Need to Know. Not surprising, because these books are very popular. Both are in their second printing. Don, how are you?
I'm great, Bill. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. We talked, I think it was the last time, about a bill that was talking about putting a tax on certain food items.
Well, the bill would actually have prevented cities and villages from taxing food that is intended for home consumption. Specifically, it would have... related to grocery store items that some cities currently tax, and under this proposed legislation, that would have been eliminated.
Like Nogales, Arizona, I think you had said the last time you were with us, 20% of their budget comes from that. So,
there are many cities around the state that derive a significant portion of their operating budgets from food tax. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this bill failed. The governor vetoed it. It was Senate Bill 1063. You and I had spoken about it last time, and the reason it was significant in part is because it involves such a large number of dollars. These revenues that are generated from food tax constitute, as you pointed out, in many cases, a significant portion of a city's operating budget. Had you taken those revenues away, it would have left a gap or a void. And there was concern by some cities that they would have a budgetary shortfall, which would affect their ability to provide fire and police protection and other essential city services. And in fact, when Governor Hobbs vetoed this bill, she sent a letter to the legislature saying that she had heard from dozens of leaders about the impact that the legislation would have had on the cities and towns. And it was, in her estimation, simply a shifting of where the money's going to come from, that if it didn't come from food tax, then it would have come from other sources, property taxes and so forth. And she didn't think that that was really a good idea, that it wouldn't essentially have eliminated costs for the residents of those cities. And so for those stated reasons, she vetoed the legislation. And as long as we're on the topic of vetoes, I think your listeners understand that bills that are passed in the legislature go to the governor for approval. So the governor has essentially one of two things that she can do. She can sign the bill, mm-hmm. in which case it'll become law, mm-hmm. or she can veto the bill. Mm-hmm. If she vetoes the bill, sometimes she'll explain her reasons for the veto. Not always, but sometimes, like in the case of Senate Bill 1063 having to do with the elimination of tax on food. She sent a letter explaining her reasons. But she's this legislative session, she's now up to, I think, 25 vetoes. In other words, 25 bills have gone to her desk for review. She signed some of them, but she's rejected at least 25, to my knowledge.
And she may be on record or on pace for a record number of vetoes, or at least as many as the last time there was a Democrat occupying the governor's office, and that would have been Janet Napolitano. So,
well, in the dynamic that is in play is that the legislature is narrowly controlled by Republicans. The governor is obviously a Democrat, so if you get these bills which are passed by party line votes, which is becoming more common, because you need everybody on board essentially to get these bills to the governor's office, there's a fair chance that the governor is going to veto the bill because it doesn't have any or significant Democrat support. So that's the dynamic in play. And what we're seeing is a large number of vetoes of bills that have been sent to her. Contrast that with last year, mm-hmm. where you had a Republican-controlled legislature, yes, and a Republican governor.
Yeah.
Governor Ducey was signing more than 300 bills into law each year.
Yeah.
An extremely large number, especially given that we have a part-time legislature. You know, our legislature...
It's a lot of bills signed into law. 300?
Over 300. Our legislature is only in session, on average, 5 months of the year. So that's a large number of bills to be sent to the governor, and that's a large number of bills to be signed by the governor, which in turn then become law.
While we're talking about vetoes, why did the governor veto killed legislation that a proponent said was designed to make it easier for people to operate their business out of their home?
Okay, so this is Senate Bill 1162, which I think was actually the governor's 25th veto of this legislative session. The governor felt that this bill, which was declared as allowing home businesses to operate as a matter of right, so long as they didn't run afoul of deed restrictions, and would have eliminated any requirement for licensing that would have been allowed by city officials. She felt that this was not in the best interest of the cities, which have a vested interest in regulating what goes on within their boundaries, that under this bill, the home businesses would be operating essentially in the shadows, or potentially in the shadows. The cities wouldn't be able to track or regulate the type of businesses that were being conducted out of their these homes. And so therefore she vetoed this bill. But she went on to say that she's generally not opposed to lessening the restrictions on home businesses, and she recognizes the importance of home businesses in the overall economy. She simply said that this proposal wasn't the right one. So I think what she's saying is she's inviting another bill that would be a little more targeted towards what the legislature said it was trying to do.
So she opened the door to that possibility.
I think so, yes.
So current law says workers that are let go through no fault of their own can get up to 24 weeks of unemployment payments. And we kind of touched on this the last time. What's happening with that legislation?
Well,
Senate bill, I believe it's 1167.
It is. So this is on the cusp of actually making its way to the governor's office as well. There's a problem with one of the Republicans in the House, however, and that's Representative David Cook, who says that he can't support the measure. And when we said earlier that the legislature is narrowly controlled by Republicans, this is a great example. There are 29 Democrats. You need 31 votes to approve any measure in the House. If you lose this Republican vote,
yes,
then this bill is not going to find its way to the governor's office. Mm-hmm. So under this proposal, it would shorten the number of weeks that an unemployed worker would be eligible to receive benefits from a maximum of 24 to a maximum of 20. And 20 would be in a period of high unemployment, which we are not in currently. Right now, our seasonally adjusted unemployment rate is 3.7%. So it's relatively low, historically and absolutely. Under this proposal, at 3.7% unemployment, which is where we're at, the maximum amount of weeks that a person could receive benefits would be 12. It would be essentially cut in half.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Now, under this proposal, it's a sliding scale. So as the unemployment rate goes up, the number of weeks that a person is entitled goes up as well.
Mm.
But the maximum, as you pointed out, would be 20 as opposed to the current 24.
Wow. We'll see what happens with Representative Cook of Globe, a Republican, whether he changes his mind. If he doesn't, this isn't going to go anywhere onto the governor. Don, I've got really only about a minute, but could you quickly summarize something concerning carrying a loaded weapon onto school grounds? This was SB 1331.
Sure. So there is a proposal which gained preliminary House approval that would allow any person who has a CCW permit, concealed weapon permit, to take a loaded firearm onto school premises. This is being advocated by Senator Shamp out of Surprise, Arizona. It would expand the privileges that are afforded people who have CCW permits. Currently, they can bring their weapons into bars, and Arizona also has reciprocity agreements with other states. So if you have a CCW permit in Arizona, you can carry a concealed weapon in another state. This would expand it so that you would also be able to carry a weapon onto school premises. There are several people and organizations who feel this is a bad idea. It was approved on a party line vote in the Senate. And so one has to ask what chance it would have on arrival on Governor Hobbs's desk.
Well, I think we can all figure that one out, right?
Anyway, I don't know if that's going to happen because there's one Republican representative who says it's a bad idea. He's not going to support it, which means that it likely will not get the requisite number of votes to make it out of the legislature.
Don Luce of Luce Law, offices in Tucson and Phoenix. Thank you, Don. Great to see you. We'll see you in early May.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, that will do it on behalf of Don Luce, Bill Buckmaster, and Tom Fairbanks. Wishing everybody well this afternoon.